Hello and welcome to the Dune Minute Podcast, where this time we're diving episode by episode into Dune prophecy. I'm one of your hosts, John.
And I'm Zach.
And we are back. It's another Monday for us right now. But last night we had a new episode. Yeah, happy Monday. Last night we had a new episode of Dune Prophecy. And I got to tell you, it was certainly an episode of TV that I've seen.
We'll get into that towards the end of this. I don't know how long we're going to record for today, but I feel like we both have some thoughts.
Yep. There's a couple thoughts stewing around in my brain hole, and I gotta get them out there. So let's just dive right on into it. Gonna kind of, you know, I think do a little bit of what we did last week, where we're kind of bouncing a little bit back and forth as we're going through the episode, and then we'll have a larger recap of everything at the end. But I want to start off with no cold open. We didn't have any cold openings this week. Just right into credits.
So that would be, what, two episodes out of the five that we've had have had cold opens?
Well,
or was it one
episode?
Could you
say that the first episode was a cold open if it was that, you know, traditional Dune, except in this case for prophecy, it was the white screen with the black text instead of the movies with the black on white?
Nah, because there was no formal like title sequence there, so I wouldn't necessarily call that a cold open. So only one of this episode, this series has had a cold open
so far. We don't know about episode six though.
Yep.
But yeah, no cold open. We're right on into it, and we're starting with what I love, which is always a good sequence of ships flying around in space in low orbit over a planet.
Oh gosh, it was great. I'll talk more about it later, but yeah, I really enjoyed this open.
Yeah. And you know, we have our ships in formation, and we're just right back to what I would call, you know, the main landing bay of Seleucus Secundus.
The spaceport.
The spaceport, as it were. And we see our stereotypical, you know, transport ship that we've been seeing, but we see something new. We see a sister that we haven't seen before ever.
Mm-hmm. Well, not in a long time.
That's true. Yeah. Not in current time, we should say. We have this sister with a, you know, seemingly special veil. Definitely hadn't seen one this ornate probably ever, because the one that Kasha and the other sisters had during the meeting between Havoco and Duke Richesi in the first episode was that kind of like diamond pattern one where it was big and open.
Yeah.
But anyways, enough about that veil. We we quickly go from the spaceport to Desmond's office, and Desmond's got some new threads.
Finally, he's out of the sandy, dusty uniform. He's into some new black suits.
He's tired of that coarse sand getting everywhere. Yeah. It's very rough.
Yeah, he hates it.
Desmond's going through a phase. It's all black. He's got,
I love it.
What I've got to say, really nice, like brass or like bronzish colored, like buttons and clasps over the front of it. I don't know. It just looks, whoever did the costume design for the show as a whole, but specifically for this, you know, new getup that Desmond has, I really love that. You know, great job to the costume department. We have a moment where Desmond is, you know, gathering all of his things and everything, and he grabs his knife, and we get to see his knife from the second episode a little closer this time. And I don't know if you noticed, but Desmond's knife has like a bone hilt looks like a giant like tooth hilt. But it didn't look like a Chris knife or a tooth of Shai Hulud.
Yeah, it's definitely a metal blade.
Yeah. Thought that was interesting. I recently we were texting over the weekend and everything, and recently watched, you know, the sci-fi Dune movie. And it's
about
just
time, man.
Reminds me of the knives from that.
Yeah.
Almost. So I wonder if it's just like a little homage to the Chris Knives from that movie, which have that very like exaggerated curve to it and everything.
Right.
But yeah, we're in Desmond's office only for a few moments to then go outside to what I could only call a courtyard.
Yeah. It's like the front door. It's almost.
Yeah. And Haviko is, you know, walking out with, you know, Empress Natalia on his arm. And for the first time, it seems he's actually getting like proper respect and bows from all of the other, you know, high nobles and lords and, you know, members of the imperial court. Just a reminder, he showed his power last week by having Desmond just execute the shit out of five other dudes and barbecue everyone in the Landsrad. So,
yeah, I think everyone's rightfully scared of him at this point.
Yeah, they're like, oh shit, we should actually like, dad's home, we're in trouble.
Yeah. This is a fun meeting. We get to see the new like Imperial Guard, I guess you'd call them now. It's the Emperor's private army, I guess.
Yeah.
And Desmond is at the head, so he has a new title. He is now the Bashar. And this is something we went back and forth with on the minute episodes, whether it's Basher or Bashar. I think we ultimately landed on Bashar, thankfully.
Yeah. Yeah. Basher just sounded dumb.
Yeah.
And also, we Googled it while we were recording, and it was definitely Bashar. And we were like, oh, shit, right. We're dumb.
We get a really impassioned speech from the Emperor. I don't know, man. We'll talk about it more, but I'm not super sold on these the costumes for the guards. It's I have some thoughts on those, but this is going to be the private army, like I said, that Desmond is going to be at the head of. So we cut from here. So there's a little jump in time. So we get after the party. Desmond is talking to the Emperor, and he says he's going to take care of all the insurgents. And that he thinks that Haviko should leave the fleet in orbit as a show of strength. So clearly Desmond is just, you know, basically calling the shots here for what's going on.
Haviko's still got his, you know, weariness about him, though. Even though people are, you know, giving him the respect that he maybe doesn't deserve, he still is undecisive.
Yeah.
Or indecisive. Yep.
But we get interrupted from this conversation when that sister who we saw at the spaceport walks in, flips back her veil, and Haviko says, Francesca.
Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah, yeah. And we get formally introduced to Taboo here, playing the role of Francesca. Wonderful, wonderful actress. I was super excited to see her here.
Yep.
Throughout this conversation, we learn that Constantine is her son. I guess I never really gave it thought. It makes sense. Because there's not too much of a resemblance to Haviko or his, the mom. So I guess, you know, having a different mother would make sense. Or Haviko and the queen.
Haviko and Natalia.
Queen. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And apparently he called for her. So she's here to see her son.
Yeah. According to Francesca, Constantine, not Haviko, called for her. Just to clarify. You know, Natalia is obviously not super pleased about Francesca being here and everything. And Francesca is like, hey, chill out. I'm not here on sisterhood business. This is a personal, you know, matter. Nevertheless, Natalia is not happy about it as we leave this scene and we're into Inez's chambers.
Yep.
Before we had left and before the whole thing with Francesca, Inez had pretty publicly stormed off away from the ceremony. You know, she basically said, he said what he needed to say, I'm getting the fuck out. And then she tells the guards, if your responsibility is to watch me, you need to keep up.
Yeah.
And then just kind of like storms off. And we find her, just kind of in her chambers.
I said meditating. it looks like she's, you know, just centering herself, taking a moment for self-care, which is great.
At the very least, just kind of steaming her thoughts by herself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And outside of the room, we hear Constantine shouting at the guards, saying that, you know, their job is to protect her, not to keep him from her. And he barges into the room. And mm-hmm. we have a pretty tender moment between the two siblings where ultimately, you know, she's not really confronting him, but just kind of asking him about, like, what the fuck happened at the Landsrad. They were supposed to do it together. And Constantine mm-hmm. recounts his side of the story that we saw, where Habako thought he was there to, or Habako thought Constantine was there to support him, and he, how proud he was and everything. And Constantine was just like, yeah, I just wanted to wish you good luck. They have an important moment where Constantine says, hey, I'm still here for you all the way through this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he really cares about her and he doesn't want to let her down again.
Mm-hmm.
As any healthy sibling relationship should be.
I agree. So we cut from here. We are back at Wallach 9, and the acolytes are holding their hand over some very futuristic Bunsen burners.
We're quite literally playing with fire here.
Yeah. Avila is talking to them about how, you know, you can transfer pain and transform pain in the body. So a lot more of that prana bindu, training that we get a lot of later in the story. But Jen, of course, is causing some trouble. She's rebelling as usual, and she gets up and she's having a very impassioned conversation with Avila about asking about the eyes and telling them that, you know, there's no truth in this organization. And really, she's just, you know, really pressing for answers. Mm-hmm. Emmeline across from her is, you know, holding the party lines, as it were. And she's just still very much the by the book sister. Avila's trying to get him under control, and Tula barges in and really just sets everyone in their place, gives them an ultimatum and says, hey, if you're not with us, you're out of here. So leave.
Yeah. Get your shit together or get the fuck out, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jen takes her seat, but Tula quickly says, no, you out. We're going somewhere else. And what she's doing is she's leading her down into the caverns or the underground passages that we saw a lot of in the prior episodes. Asked for her discretion in what she's about to see. And John, what does she see?
A giant metal door.
Okay. Well, after the door,
it's important because it's a giant, like, metal prison door, like you would expect, with the little, you know, small flap to kind of mm-hmm. open up. Very and Tula familiar. opens that flap, and we just see a screaming and out of control Lila from behind the door, which the first time I saw it, I kind of laughed almost at the, you know, mm-hmm. it felt very campy horror. Like they tried to do a jump scare in Dune, and Dune isn't a show that you do jump scares in. this is a absolutely out of control Lila, and we are seeing the ramifications of Tula's experimentation on the, you know, body of Lila. And as Tula and Jen are wrestling with this out of control, I don't want to call her really a person because she's more of a husk.
She's a person. She's got a lot of other people inside her too.
as they're wrestling control of Lila, we basically get enough exposition from Tula to say, like, hey, you know, she's still all fucked up. We have to kind of guide her back slowly mm-hmm. and carefully because there's a lot that's going on inside her head. And we, through the chaos, have a tender moment where Jen is, you know, pleading to Lila to, you know, follow her voice and to come back and everything.
And it works. She calms down.
We get that moment of Lila calming down and everything, and they make sure that she's Shakira. They make sure she's Shakira. Say that five times fast. Make sure she's secure in the straps and everything in this quote unquote hospital bed. I guess what it reminded me of. And, you know, Tula says she's got some other things to take care of, but it's Jen's responsibility to watch over Lila. Here's a, you know, little sedative if you absolutely need to use it, but try not to.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we're off with more of that tender moment once again, where Lila's slowly coming back more and more. Mm-hmm. And then we're done on Wallach for a little bit. We're going to hop back over to Seleucia Secundus because we got some important stuff to talk about over there.
That's right. So back at the palace, Francesca is meeting up with Constantine for the much anticipated mother-son talk. We learn here that Constantine did not send a crystal for her. I'm not sure what the crystal is, but for all intents and purposes, a message. Did not send a message to her, asking her to come. And he gets to break the news that that Sister Kasha is dead. She did not know about this. And she's genuinely shocked to hear this. So still over at the palace, we get another visit. The Baron Harkonnen, Harrow, visits Desmond in his new office. I guess old office, but he's got a bunch more trinkets in there now.
He loves his toys.
Yeah. And they're pretty cool toys from the looks of them. But
yeah,
he's there to really just kind of grovel for forgiveness. He's sorry for his accusation at the Landsrad meeting yesterday or the day before or whatever it was.
However long this indiscernible amount of time has been.
Yeah, earlier. And it really seems like he's throwing Valya under the bus here and that, you know, saying that he doesn't trust her, he never should have listened to her, all that jazz. Desmond is initially just kind of like, no, you don't need to be talking to me. You need to talk to the Emperor about this. But Harrow does this this really cool, like, well, yeah, I could talk to him, but don't you have his ear? Aren't you the one who really is really calling the shot? So really in kind of ingratiated himself onto Desmond. And Desmond wants to use him at this point. He wants to help. He wants Harrow to find the link between the sisterhood and the rebellion that they're trying to squash. Space Cocaine gets another appearance here. So they both do a bump as they're talking. And Harrow goes into this really odd story. And you can just see the look on Desmond's face. He's like, I do not give a shit about this. But it does have a good payoff where it convinces him or gives him the idea to, you know, check with the smugglers and you'll find your rebellion there.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's necessarily an odd story. It's more just like, you know, there are things other than spice that are being tampered with in regards to trade. And ultimately it all falls in one place. And kind of getting into a little bit of my commentary here, but why the fuck isn't Desmond immediately thinking, hey, maybe I should go check out some of the seedy parts of the city where like smugglers are known to be?
Like there's a lot. Yeah.
Somehow this is a revelation to Desmond, but we'll get into that in our commentary later on.
Yeah. So as a thank you, he's not off the hook, but he does get a thank you from Desmond. And he gives him this glowy ball looking thing that has the same blue inside as the other thinking machines that we've seen. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that later. So back at the condo, the Harkonnen condo, Francesca is confronting Valya about not telling her about Kasha. And the reason we get is because the Spacing Guild, you know, monitors all sorts of incoming, outgoing transmissions. So it was very risky. At this point, Valya basically clues Francesca into the plot of the show regarding the sisterhood. So we get a nice little recap there. And we learn that Valya is planning to kill Desmond. And Francesca's job throughout all this is to guide Havoco and to get Inez back to the school. That is her ultimate goal here. She plants the seed of she wants Constantine to lead the fleet, and that could be a really good spot for the son of a sister to be in. And she's going to make sure that Desmond is not an obstacle while Francesca's doing her job.
And then after we spend our time in the apartment and everything, we head on back to the palace. We mm-hmm. are back in, I don't know if you would want to call it, you know, Kieran's office. It's not really an office. It's more of a dojo, but it's not like the dojo on Kalan. It's where Kieran does all of his dancing practice, shall we say.
Yeah. I just call it a training room.
Yeah, it's the training room, and Kieran's, you know, putting some kind of data chip in his locker, and he doesn't really put it away fully. We happen to know what this data chip has on it as the viewers, because we've been seeing everything, but we'll find out a little more later on in the episode. Desmond and his goons show up. They're just, you know, gooning through hallways and stuff.
Cannot escape the gooners.
Cannot escape them. Desmond and the goons are there looking for insurgents, and he offers to invite Kieran to join them to search for, you know, traitors amongst the city and everything. But Constantine is there for his dance lesson. So Desmond and the goons, you know, go off gooning somewhere else while Kieran kind of puts Constantine in his place for being late and, you know, mm-hmm. not owning up to his, you know, lateness or to his tardiness and everything. And basically shoves his sword into Constantine's chest and says, "That's your lesson for the day. Own up to your mistakes," and just kind of storms off.
Yep.
And we find out why he storms off very quickly too, because he's going immediately to the bar where Michaela is to give her the, you know, heads up that Desmond is tearing through the underbelly of the city, and it's only a matter of time before he shows up at that bar. Yep. Michaela, in anticipation of all of this, had already started playing some, or had already started planting some remote detonator charges in strategically placed locations to blow the bar the fuck up.
Yeah. Neither of them really want to like leave. It doesn't seem like. I mean, they both have a lot invested here. Yeah, she's about to just light this place up as soon as Desmond gets in there, or maybe as a secondary measure, but she's definitely like, she's about to, you know, give him a warm welcome or something like that, as she says.
Yeah, definitely plan B if needed.
Yeah, for sure. We'll have to wait a little bit, though, to see the outcome of that, because right after this conversation between Kieran and Michaela, we snap back over to Wallach 9, and we get a ship landing, and they're very... rudimentary spaceport, and a bunch of the acolytes get on the ship. Someone is walking off, and it is a box that is handed to Sister Avila, presumably the one with Desmond's blood in it. And we get to see Emmeline and her gang are looking over from their specific looking ledge.
Their specific looking ledge happened to be the one where all the sisters committed to the sisterhood in mm-hmm. the flashback episode 3.
Yeah, that's right. We scooch on over to the medical chamber where Lila is, you know, still on the bed. She seems to be conscious and talking, and her and Jen are just trading back and forth. So, you know, pleasantries and just getting to talk again, because they said goodbye to each other a couple episodes ago. While Chen's looking down, we get a funny face from Lila, and when she comes back up, it is clear that she is not the same person.
She's no longer Lila. After a quick convulsion, she's someone else.
Yep. So she starts talking to all sorts of stuff that she should have no business knowing about Raquel's deathbed vision and all this kind of stuff. And Jen gets the hint pretty quick and takes her to see Tula in their science lab. I love how Raquel gets straight to scolding and to science. She just barges in. She's just like, "All right, let's go. Get me caught up. Where are we at? What's going on? We
ain't got much time." Tula's like, "What the fuck? I told you to keep her downstairs and everything." And like the moment that I'm just going to call her Raquel, the moment that Raquel starts talking, Tula's like, "Oh shit. All right. Big boss is here." But it was nice to kind of see that, you know, reunion, you know, between Rikella and Tula. Rikella is just kind of, while she's barking orders at Jen, you know, rerunning data and everything through their machine, and, you know, asking for samples of Kasha's brain, which are right in front of her. One line in particular kind of stuck out to me, which, you know, wasn't a surprise or anything, but it was just when Rikella asks if Valya and Dorothea had ever resolved their differences, and Tula's non-answer was enough of an answer for Rikella to kind of put two and two together. But we do, you know, going back to the brain stem thing, we do get a really cool, you know, visualization of what had been going on to Kasha's brain stem. And we see these, you know, huge black spots in this slice of the sample. Ultimately, Rikella basically says this is tissue damage that she had seen during the Butlerian Jihad. They call it the war in the show, but it is the Butlerian Jihad, and this was familiar to her. Another interesting line was that she had feared that her great work would be lost. That kind of perked Jen's ears, and Jen was like, "What?" And both Rikella and Tula are like, "Shut the fuck up.
Stop asking questions. You didn't hear
anything." Yeah. Just do what you were told.
Yep. And we will get more from them here in just a little bit. But right now we cut back over to the condo, and Harrow is not a traitor after all. He was just doing what Valya had told him to do when he was talking to Desmond. And he does cast a little bit of shade on the sisterhood for their for their, you know, shady dealings. To which Valya just says, "You need to trust me, man. You know, just don't worry about what I'm doing. Trust me."
And then she places Evgeny's, you know, Harkonnen ring on Harrow's hand. And I think that's a moment to say, like, hey, this is for Harkonnens.
Yep, exactly. Harrow's off to Evgeny's funeral, and Valya will not be joining him. And I guess she lives there now. The condo is officially hers while he's gone.
It's a timeshare.
Yeah.
Exactly. All Harkonnens get a month out of the year and they can, you know, do with it as they please. Yeah, just make sure you clean it up, or at least hire cleaners to, you know, take care of your mess before you leave.
Exactly. Exactly. Theodosia is there. You know, she didn't have a lot to say in this episode, but she's kind of lurking in the background for a lot of this. And we get some words between her and Valya about imprinting.
Yeah, we get another like sneaky introduction of a very important thing in Dune.
Yeah. Yep. And we really get to see a direct example of this. So it's really not much of a you don't have to wait too long before we get a payoff, because we cut around to Havoco and Francesca. They're walking and talking, and we get some, you know, sexual tension, some allusion. I mean, obviously, you know, they have a past, and she's trying to convince Havoco to give Constantine some actual responsibility. You know, if you give him a job, he'll step up to it. He's just never been tested before.
I love that Havoco through all of this was like, oh, he's just a, you know, boy, and the only responsibility he's ever had is just rummaging through the bedrooms of all these women. And he's like, and Francesca's like, yeah, dumbass, you were the same way when you were younger too.
if you want your son to be great,
give him something, some greatness to, you know, drive towards.
Yeah.
I think she says something like, you need to treat him more like a son and not manage him.
Mm-hmm.
Which is such a, like, calling Havoco out on another aspect of his bullshit thing that needed to happen.
Man, he's just getting it from all angles these last couple episodes.
Yeah.
Deservedly so. So after a very awkward kiss, Francesca leaves, and we cut back over to Wallach, where we get to see the rest of the science that is still happening.
Yeah, we're back in AP bio class, dude.
Heck yeah. And John, we get Omnius mentioned.
Yeah, we get our first mention of the Omnius plague. And I think the context of how Omnius was mentioned is super important. So I want to take this scene from the top. Avila has the package from UPS, and she's bringing it to Tula.
Space UPS,
of course. Avila has the package from Valia that was delivered earlier that we saw, and she's bringing it to Tula's laboratory. And Tula's being really sneaky, where she kind of like quickly opens the door and ducks back out and everything, and is standing in front of the door, blocking Avila from entering. And Avila's like, "What's going on in there?" And she's like, "You don't need to worry about it. It's fine. Everything's fine." And then while Tula is doing all of this, just the door opens from behind her and Lila bursts her head out and is like, "Hey, so this is something during the Omnius plague. Machines designed this pathogen to affect the liver, but this one is, you know, doing the brainstem and everything, and it's settling in the amygdala, which is the center of fear." She grabs the box and then closes the door behind her. And but before she closes the door, she's like, "Oh, hi, Avila," and then just closes the door, which I thought was hilarious.
Definitely
meant to be a comedic relief moment. There are not many of those in this show, but that was, I loved that. Kind of like as a scene and everything. And then we get a super important thing where Lila by Avila is referred to as an abomination.
Yep.
Yes. We got imprinting, we got Omnius, and we got abomination all within like 5 minutes of each other in this episode.
Yeah. I didn't think this was like capital A abomination, as we'll come to learn it later, but it definitely is a nice little foreshadowing to the capital A abomination. But yeah, my ears perked up and I went, "Woo," when I heard this.
And basically Avila's like, "What the fuck is this bullshit?" And Tula's response is, "Look, Valia told me to protect the sisterhood at all costs. This is all costs." Yep. Avila's not happy about it, and she's just kind of, you know, left outside of the laboratory. And I think we're setting up for some bullshit with Avila for sure next episode. Yeah.
You can tell that she's kind of getting towards the end of her rope, I would say.
Yeah.
We cut from here back to the club, and Desmond and his boys are marching in. So they're gooning in the club now.
And just gooning all over the underbelly of the city.
Yeah. After some quick dialogue between Desmond and Michaela, Desmond gives the signal to start trashing the place. So they're turning the place upside down, trying to find any kind of connection to the smugglers and to the resistance, or rebellion, I should call them. She's not giving them anything. So Desmond finds the secret button to open up the back rooms, and they go.
Desmond and several of his boys go upstairs, and then two of the gooners get sent downstairs.
Right. So they're gooning in the basement.
They're just going downstairs to goon, and who's downstairs is but Kieran Atreides, who steals the sword of one of them, stabs the shit out of the first guy, and then immediately runs through and kills the other guy downstairs. So yeah. Gooner's down, gone but never forgotten.
He died doing what they loved.
Kieran is quickly setting the rest of the bombs and pushes the arming on the detonator, and upstairs Michaela, even though she's being watched by one of the goons, is looking in the corner, and she sees the light go from white to green to red, and she knows it's go time. As Kieran comes upstairs, kills the guard that's keeping an eye on her, and she and Kieran are just fighting their way out.
Yep.
Meanwhile, upstairs in the bar, the spice has been found by Desmond and some of his goons, and they're kind of searching through everything. Desmond finds a very interesting thing that is that should not be in one of the spice containers. It's a black dress. Mm-hmm. Dun, dun, dun. But he doesn't hold on to it for too long, because as Kieran and Michaela are fighting their way out, notably with Michaela's little pocket knife, yeah, everything begins to fucking explode around them. And Desmond, in the last second, you know, just activates his Holtzman shield. And we're left with outside shots of the building exploding, and then Kieran and Michaela stumbling their way out of this exploded building. They have a moment with each other where Michaela is basically like, look, not all or all of us have our own secrets. And Kieran's all like, ah, you fucking Bene Gesserit, I've seen that knife before. And yeah, he's just like, I don't want to ever see you again. And they kind of go their own ways.
Yep. Bad terms, cover's blown, they're out of there. Back on Wallach, Jen confronts Tula about Lila being used for the sisterhood gain. So this is kind of the whole thing that she's been talking about for a number of episodes now, is that the sisters are just using these acolytes for their, you know, for their plans. They're just pawns in this game.
Surprise, that's the entirety of the sisterhood.
Yeah, like, right.
Jen, get your shit together.
You mean to tell me the people who use the Imperium as pawns would use their own acolytes as pawns?
No.
Get out of here. Get out of here.
No.
So she asked Tula a very important question. She asked what she's sacrificed for the sisterhood. And Tula gives a very like cryptic answer. And she says more than she can imagine, or more than you can imagine. So we don't linger here. We cut back over to the club, and surprise, somehow Desmond is alive.
Somehow Palpatine has returned.
And he, you know, he gets up from all the rubble and just stumbles out of the building.
Yeah. Notably not holding a dress.
Right, right.
And then we cut back to the palace. Constantine is taking all of his anger out on the test dummies and everything. And, you know, we see more Holtzman shield as Constantine's beating the shit out of this poor test dummy. He kind of, you know, takes a seat and in his frustration and looks up at the ceiling. And we get a very reminiscent shot to the shots in Dune Part One, where we are looking at the bullhead over, you know, the doorways in in the Atreides castle, but in this case it's the Carino sigil. I just thought that was a cool nod to Denis's, you know, own storytelling and everything.
Sure.
But we're quickly interrupted by Francesca arriving and basically sitting with Constantine and saying, hey, you know, what's going on? And Constantine's like, I've learned everything about the entire history of the Carinos and the butlers before them and everything, but I know nothing about you and I know nothing about your family. And Constantine kind of has a moment where he's lamenting not knowing his own purpose in life, and, you know, that he knows that he was only just a part of this grand plan of the sisterhood and everything. And he's upset that, you know, he was left to be raised by a father that can't stand him and never will. And Francesca just kind of has a moment where she says, look, ultimately, you know, your purpose is to protect your sister, the future of the Imperium, especially from those who claim to love her.
Yeah. So he has his marching orders now, effectively. You know, this is the seed that Francesca was supposed to be planting, and thank goodness Desmond was not there to get in the way.
Yeah. Well, one of the seeds, because she was also there to, you know, guide Havoco back towards the sisterhood, which we'll get into that a little bit later.
Yep. So back at the condo, Michaela is talking to Valia and to Valia and Theodosia.
Too many names.
yeah, she's basically like, well, he didn't, somehow he survived. I don't know how, but he was not among the dead. Valya offers her passage back to their safe house on Arrakis. And Michaela's like, WTF, man, I just worked, like, I just destroyed everything I had. And she's kind of pissed that they're just asking her to leave now, as if it was wasted. And Valya puts those concerns to rest, sort of. In this conversation, Theodosia kind of spouts some, I call it indoctrinated bullshit. Because
yeah, that's what it is.
And Michaela snaps back and is like, ah, so you're molding this one in your image here. I get very much like Jen vibes. So Michaela and Jen, I think, are cut from the same cloth.
Well, you missed the important part of the scene, though, where Michaela says, I wouldn't do this to my people. Saying, you know, talking about the Fremen, she wouldn't sell out her own people. And that's when Theodosia is like, well, your people is the Sisterhood.
Yeah.
The Fremen sense of self and, you know, community and everything is obviously very important. Even through years and years of, you know, being in the Sisterhood is still, you know, very instilled in Michaela in this case.
Yeah.
And almost to the point where, you know, Michaela starts talking shit about how she doesn't believe in Valya's plans anymore. And Valya stops her very quickly because, you know, if she actually went through with the insult, I think Valya would have just done her in right then and there.
Probably, yeah.
But yeah, her parting words are, let's see how long you remain this naive acolyte. And then just, you know, goes down the elevator, and that's the end of our scene there.
Yep.
And then we're back with Constantine in the training room, and he's, you know, putting swords up in the locker and sees this little data chip that Kieran had just kind of left on the bottom of the locker in a rush, and finds a hidden cabinet underneath, and what's in there but the scanner and the little projector, and the chip has the whole map of the palace.
That's right.
And Constantine is not dumb. He puts two and two together pretty quickly, and we kind of cut a few minutes, maybe a couple hours later, and Kieran is returning from his escapades across the city to find Constantine just kind of sitting, waiting. And Constantine is there to, you know, give him this big bravado of, you know, thank you for everything you've done for me and everything you've tried to teach me. You know, I've been, you know, a bit of a fool, but you've now reminded me of my purpose.
Those are his exact words. Yep.
And then he gives this very Desmond-esque bow to Kieran as he's being apprehended by palace guards.
Yeah.
We then cut to dinner time, where we see Constantine being rewarded for his discovery and everything, and how, you know, Habako is so proud of his son, and specifically Habako and his mother are so proud of their son.
Mm-hmm. The shade. Natalia is just, she's left out, not happy.
She's just, you know, devastated here. And Inez is devastated to find that, you know, her son, or that her brother, is kind of going against what, you know, he told her in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Not that, you know, she really, you know, explained that Kieran was actually an ally to their purpose and everything, but she still sees this as a slight and everything against her. And in this moment, Inez and Natalia, while everyone else is celebrating at the table and, you know, toasting to Constantine, or kind of eyeing each other diagonally across the whole thing. And Natalia's just fed up and over it, and she just like gets up and storms off, and everyone stops to look at her except for Habako, who's just, you know, focused entirely on his son, you know, talking across the table and everything.
Yeah.
We get this big, loud, you know, pulse in our ears and everything, and we hard cut away from the table to the jail.
Yeah.
We've seen our suspension before when Desmond was in jail, but this time it's Kieran. And Inez approaches, and we see her kind of take a moment to herself and does the little, you know, finger truth tap sense thing for truth sense. Yeah. Begins asking questions, and basically is asking, you know, like, hey, was everything a lie? And, you know, do you really believe you can bring about a better Imperium? And then evidently got all the answers that she wanted and got the responses that she wanted and gave a slight nod of approval before leaving.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're done on Seleucus Secundus for a second. We'll be back. Don't worry. Because this is Dune Prophecy.
Yeah, we're back on Wallach, and Jen is talking to Lila Actual. And she says that she's done her part in getting the Raquella back and, you know, being able to talk with Tula and explain, you know, just help them out with all this this confusing stuff that they're doing. In another part of the school, Tula is conferring with the computer and starts the DNA scan of Desmond, of the scrap of cloth that was shipped in. And what do you know? We get literal family trees start to pop up all around her.
I thought the CGI for this sequence was so fucking cool.
It was really good. I'm not knocking on that. I'm saying that the literal family trees was a little bit on the nose. That's my only complaint about that part. But
I don't know. Yes, I thought it was cool.
No, it was fine. It was just, okay, we need to explain what this is to people. Show it as a tree.
Yeah. You gotta have it normie accessible.
So, right at, I think we're entering into our like last, rapid fire scenes, of the show, and we're back in the palace, and Desmond is looking at the scrap of cloth that he keeps with him. Natalia shows up, and starts this big monologue about her purpose and how the Bene Gesserit, you know, took that from her and how she's been undermined, by them. And at the same time, Francesca and Havoco are getting busy. Seems like they're, sharing a very intimate moment.
Yeah. They're not having sex. They're doing the weird, like open shirt, hand on the heart thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
I guess shout out HBO special for not having sex two episodes in a row. Congratulations. Yeah. You can do it.
I feel like this means that the last episode is going to be 50% sex scenes.
Oh God. We don't have time for 50% sex scenes.
So during all this, back on Wallach, Tula learns that Desmond is part Atreides and part Harkonnen. We get the nice little joining of a family tree and a picture of an infant. And she is just shocked to learn this. It's like surprise and fear mixed together in her face.
Yep.
So I guess TBD on what's going to become of this. Rapid fire back to the palace. Desmond says that his mother was a sister and gave him up to live among scavengers. That's why it's clearly why he hates them so much, or at least part of why he hates them so much. Natalia and Desmond share a kiss. And after the kiss is done, Natalia says she wants to rid the universe of these witches
forever.
Forever. Yeah.
Let us rid the Imperium of these witches forever.
Yep. And we get credits right after that. So there it is. In Truth, Blood, the fifth episode of Dune Prophecy.
I want to start off our analysis and everything with one thing. I was fucking right. Not that it was a stretch, but the fact that Desmond was Tula's son.
Yeah.
As soon as I saw the, you know, whole flashback sequence with Tula and, you know, her acceptance of the proposal for marriage and the long, you know, awkward sex scene there, I was like, all right, yeah, no, he's got to be, like, he has to be Atreides and Harkonnen.
Yes, I understand that. that fits into the overall story. Like, you know, Harkonnen and Atreides have a kid. Their kid has special powers or whatever. You know, like that's the same story that we saw with Paul in you know, the Dune movies and in the books. So I understand that it fits into the story, but it makes the universe so much smaller.
It does. And I agree. This is definitely becoming, you know, everyone's a Skywalker shit.
Yes.
However, we know that thanks to what Raquella.
We can call her Lykella.
Lykella.
Yeah.
So we have Chal and Lykella. Got it.
Yep. People are going to have to listen to a lot of minutes to figure out that joke.
Yeah, they're going to have to. That's not really a deep dive, but I don't think we talk about Chal until at least episode 100.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. Okay, so she says, you know, during the Omnius Plague, machines designed a pathogen affecting the liver. The enzyme is similar, concentrates in the amygdala, the fear center. And then... She says it's a genetically modified airborne retroactive RNA, or it's an airborne RNA retrovirus. Mm-hmm. So if it was created during the Omnius Plague, who's to say that it couldn't be like some kind of nano machine or whatever that, you know, infects the body with this, which makes sense with the, you know, heavy breathing out thing and, you know, Desmond having to get close to all of the people that he's infected with this and what have you. I think this is where because it's set in the amygdala in the fear center of the brain, for certain we're seeing the litany against fear next week. But
I'd be shocked if we didn't.
Oh, it would be stupid writing if they didn't, but this does quell one of the fears that you and I have had, where this is just space magic. It's not space magic. We know that it is a virus now. There is a scientific explanation for this, whether it is Bene Tlalax or Ixion or what have you. It is some kind of actual, like, explainable thing, not just woo magic.
I was so very happy when they actually put a name to this.
And that was the saving grace of this episode for me.
Yes, for sure. Now my question is, how does he control it? And that's where I think we're going to get into the Ixion stuff, or Tlalaxu stuff. So honestly, like the Gola Proto-Kwisatz-Haderach theory that we talked about, it's still around. It's still viable. It's just we get a little bit more of the why behind that here.
Yep.
So I get it. It makes sense, the Harkonnen Atreides combo. That's the story that, you know, we're ultimately telling here, or they're ultimately telling here. I just hope that it comes along with expanding the universe a little bit, not just saying, okay, the entire story is about these two families having kids. Spoilers for later in Dune. Sorry.
I mean, I think if you're listening to episode 5 of this, you've been listening before, and we've had spoiler warnings for all of the books and everything, and it's just kind of expected at this point. Having an actual explanation of the virus and everything was just like, oh, thank God. Thank you.
Yep. I agree. Really. What do you make of Kieran just leaving his super incriminating evidence in an unlocked footlocker, basically?
I think Kieran, flew a little too close to the sun with the confidence of his security and his position. Or he's just a dumbass. he was putting it in there thinking about being sneaky and heard the, you know, footsteps and didn't take an extra half second to quickly slip it in there. Or like there's an actual hole that he could have just dropped the thing into.
Dude. I'm approaching this from a slightly different angle. I think that stuff was planted there. I think because he tells Michaela in the bar that he spent years getting to this position, so he is careful.
Yeah,
you know, that shows a certain level of aptitude for subterfuge. So I think I think Francesca planted the stuff there to get Constantine to look into Kieran, to find this, get in the good graces of Havoco, get into the position of fleet commander.
Sure. No, I mean, what do the Bene Gesserit do best if not subterfuge, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Plans yeah. within plans within plans kind of thing. So
yeah, measured in centuries, yada, yada, yada.
Et cetera, et cetera. How do you think the Souk doctors, how do you think they didn't catch this earlier?
I have no idea, because you would have thought that the Souk School of Medicine and the Souk doctors would be able to detect like something that anomalous in the brain.
Especially being so close to the machine wars, you know, that was, this is yeah. something used in the machine wars. So it's not exactly like, ancient history at that point.
Like, I can understand if, you know, the Souk school is early on, but like, even now, if someone like dies and, you know, you have an autopsy and everything done on the body, you're gonna like look at the brain is like probably one of the first things you're looking at, unless there's a very clear and obvious like cause of death, right? But I feel like the brain is probably one of the things you're going to study the earliest and everything. I'm not a mortician, don't at me. If you are a mortician, actually email us, let us know what the exact process is like. Like, how do you prioritize shit? Or you can hit us up on Blue Sky at duneminute.com.
Yep.
But
yeah, I don't know. I was like, I feel like that's something they maybe should have caught. Maybe it doesn't present until much later after death. Who knows? But maybe Rakella has some special way of figuring this stuff out. Who knows? This is not going to be explained. It's just a thought that rang in my head. I was like, how did they not catch this earlier?
Yeah. I think they left it for Rakella. Like,
yeah,
obviously they had the sample of the brain and you could see that black spot on it and everything. But mm-hmm. it's just like.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know I realize that we're going to be bouncing around during a lot of this part of the podcast and everything. And that's fine because that's just how my brain works. I want to talk about Desmond's goons here for a second.
Yes. Yeah.
We you hinted at some opinions on that earlier on.
You mean the people from Assassin's Creed that he
has? No, they don't have the hoods, because
they're wearing Assassin's... hoods. They're wearing hoods in the initial meeting that they're in, and they have face masks. So
I guess they kind of do. Yeah,
not kind of, man. They're like fully in hoods with face masks on. It looked a lot like the Assassin's Creed main character. I forget his name.
I'm not going to call these guys the Sardaukar because that is wrong to do so. I think this is laying the groundwork for what will become the Sardaukar over, you know, thousands of years.
Yeah.
But also, like, did Havoco and the Kreenos just not have their whole ass own army? Like, why the fuck didn't they just use that? Like, what the fuck, dude?
I
would assume you have a military of some degree, because if you don't, all these other houses in the Landsrat are just gonna fucking stomp your ass. They don't owe Havoco shit. They owe the butlers and, you know, the first Kreenos, but Havoco's, you know, what, three emperors three down four. The line or whatever. Like, come on, dude.
I had that exact same thought and on both accounts, like, yes, we're not going to get the Sardaukar name here. This is clearly, I think, a first stab at that. Pardon the pun. Why did they not already have some kind of like royal imperial army or whatever? They're not that far away from the machine wars. You know, it feels like there's something
150, 200 years at this point.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
In the scale of the Dune timeline, they are not that far away from it at all. I thought that was a little strange, but yeah, whatever. Clearly Havoco has made some not great choices already in this.
Havoco fucking sucks as an emperor. Like, he's just a really shitty emperor.
Yeah. Mark Strong's doing a fantastic job, but
yeah, the character. Mark Strong's fucking killing it, but yeah. His character is just a weak, sad little man.
Yep. Okay. Can we talk about the shields for a second?
Let's talk about the shields.
You talk about the shields for a second. I've been dying to talk about the shields all day.
I have, actually.
We have talked at length about this on various episodes of the Dune Minute.
Yep.
I think they are just inventing different and new ways that the shields can save people.
This is why I hate Brian Cannon. Brian Cannon sucks ass.
Well, I don't know if this is from the books or not. I don't know. I know that Desmond is a show character. He's not a book character. So this could be something that the show invented, but then again, Brian has a hand in the show. So yeah.
Brian is an executive producer. He has more than a hand in the show.
So I can believe that the shields, you know, he got it on quick enough, which how he knew what was about to happen and got it in the last second, that deserves its own turn under the microscope. But I can believe that the shield would have protected him from shrapnel that was around, you know, flying mm-hmm. debris and everything like that. But we know it is on screen that inertia is preserved through the shields. So the pressure alone from this blast would have like liquefied him.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it would have turned him into like a fucking Capri Sun inside the shield temporarily. And then like he would have slowly seeped out from it and everything. But also like you said, inertia is preserved. We see in the first 10 or 15 minutes of Dune Part 1, Gurney Halleck just fucking stabbed the shit out of Paul's gut with a knife at like full speed. And we watch Paul just like fucking take a knee super hard.
Yeah.
So yes, the shrapnel and everything, but also you got to remember too, the flames and the carbon monoxide are slow moving enough to pass through the shield. So why the fuck wasn't Desmond just absolutely incinerated if he wasn't liquefied from the forceful impact or choked to death on carbon monoxide poisoning? Like,
yeah,
the fucking Deus Ex Machina on this character is driving me fucking insane. Like, I get it. When there's a fire, it's good to get low to avoid the smoke. But then carbon monoxide is heavier than air, so that gets low. And then you fucking, like, homie was passed out. I would assume not for terribly long, but.
Yeah, I will say one thing.
That whole sequence was so frustrating to me.
Yeah. It truly was. I'll say one thing. I'll give it. It's one flower here. It's nice that we finally got a visual representation of plot armor.
Yeah. Yeah. Desmond's plot armor is fucking
a mile thick.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. I don't know. I was just like, I can't. This is just, here's the hand wavy magic part. We get an answer for the virus. Fine and good. That's great. But then Desmond just survives this blast that should not have been survivable. So whatever, I guess.
Yeah.
We need him. We need him for the last episode. Let's talk about Lila, Constantine, and Inez.
Constantine, and Inez.
We'll start with Lila. No connection. Just those are the three people I want to talk about.
Oh, okay. I was like, how the fuck does Lila?
No. We didn't really get too much of Lila's going crazy other than the very first scene. Like, she seems to be pretty well put together for the rest of the show once Jim comes down. For now, yes. So I still think that door is open. But yeah, they just got a little bit to go in this. So it's like, and this kind of rolls up to a larger thing that I was going to talk about in a while, but this show has a ton of threads that they need to close up on this last mm-hmm. episode. Lila is being one of the bigger ones, in my opinion.
So here's my, I mean, this isn't, you know, an earth-shattering prediction or whatever, but Dorothea is going to show up next episode. Dorothea is going to see, you know, Emmeline and all of her bullshit and just like immediately, you know, take advantage of all of that and everything. And then it's going to come down to either Tula or Jen having to fucking kill the Abomination. And in doing so, possibly, probably also kill Emmeline or, you know, that whole group in the sect. Because once again, we got the line from Raquella, not Lila Raquella, where she was basically like, hey, you know, it was a risk to put both of them in place and fracture the sisterhood, but I'm glad that it didn't actually fracture.
Yeah.
This is going to be another moment of fracturing. And, you know, obviously we know that it survives, but I think we're going to see a lot of at least one, probably two, maybe unlikely, but maybe more deaths in the sisterhood next episode.
Oh, for sure. I'm expecting a number of them. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think Dorothea is going to show up. Knock, knock, bitch, open up. On Lila next and episode. And
we've not got a season two confirmed yet. I'm not sure if there's going to be a season two. You know, they're saying this is the last episode.
But it's setting up like it's going to be a fucking season two. And don't like that. I do not like that at all. Like, fucking wrap it up, bitch.
Yeah.
Then do a Mentat series. So I want a Mentat series.
You know, maybe this will bleed into another series that they're going to do. Like this, the Dorothea Abomination theory. If they decide to go down that road.
Give me a chair dog series.
I really hope that they don't just leave it at Avila calling her an abomination in passing almost. And that's the only like bit that we get for it. That would be sorely disappointing.
I think when Dorothea shows up and is all knock, knock, bitch, is when we're going to get the actual capital A abomination.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So you wanted to talk about Constantine and Inez. Mm-hmm. I want to start with Inez.
Okay.
Because so we know that Kasha had given her like some preliminary truth sense training and whatnot. But for her to just like fucking whip that shit out and just fully use it on.
It seemed less Kieran refined. Atreides,
sure. But it's like, this is very, you know, quickly learning how to use the force kind of shit going on.
Yeah, that's how Rey was able to become so good so quick, right? In that scene where she's in the prison, there's the suspensor cells. When we see Kieran talking and we're like kind of viewing it through the truth sense, it seems like it is it's a lot more chaotic than we've seen it in the past.
Like when we saw Valia's talking to Desmond through her perspective and everything.
Yeah. Or even,
even Theodosia. Kasha with Desmond or Theodosia. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that she has like the basics down, but she's not very good at it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just me trying to explain this. There's no indication that we've gotten that is the case, but that's to me the most likely reason for her. It just being so muddy, I guess.
Yeah.
I think, so just some predictions for the finale here. I think Inez is going to do something, that will cause her to betray the family. Fall out of good grace with them, and she'll have to either escape to the sisterhood or to some other planet. And what I think that thing is
Constantine.
Nope. What I think that thing is that she's going to help Kieran escape.
So she's 100% like, yeah. Oh, I love this man.
Yeah, so we're going to get, I think we're going to get that story. Constantine has already shifted his view in the family, so it's going to set him up for taking the claim to the throne from Inez mm-hmm. after she's gone. So,
which well, is yeah, you don't just become, you know, commander of a fleet and then just stop with that when your dad's the emperor, like yeah, regardless exactly. of your parentage. Like, I mean, if you want to go that route, right? Like by that logic, Paul shouldn't have been fucking Duke of the Atreides after the death of Leto because his parents weren't married, you know.
Sure.
Jessica well, was imprinted on Jessica was imprinted on Leto, but
well, he was legitimized.
Sure. And I think the scene at dinner was to legitimize Constantine.
Yep. Agreed. Who is the main character in this show? Because I haven't been able know. To figure it out. I haven't been able to figure that out yet.
Valia, is she though? Maybe. Valia, but also Desmond, not Tula, not Inez.
Yeah, I've not been able to figure out like who I not saying who I should be rooting for. I'm not rooting for any of them. But who is the kind of the through line into this story? Which is tough because you would think towards the end of a series, you would be able to know, you know, like where to look and where to follow. So it just feels like, I don't know, this is me talking about production stuff now, but it feels like they initially wrote a 10 to 12 episode series for, you know, various reasons that we've talked about at length. It got cut down to 6. They did not trim off enough fat on the show. And now we're going into a episode 6 finale with a ton of stuff that's going to be needing to be resolved. And one of those yeah, is mean, who is the main character of the show.
This is what happens when you don't pay your writers and then your writers strike. So yep. pay your fucking writers. I think that's going to be, I think the writer's strike, which, to reiterate, I am 1,000% behind the writers and mm-hmm. The demands that they had. While the deal was struck, I think the deal didn't go far enough in favor of the writers, but they at least, you know, have their jobs and they have their pay. They have, you know, most of the things that they asked for. This falls on production for not, I think, giving them time to go back and fix a lot of things and the rushed production, because if you look at the history of this entire series, like it's been through production hell for years.
Yeah.
I think they started like pre-production and development back in, you know, 2020 around the time like this. I think this was supposed to come out between movie 1 and movie 2.
Okay. Yeah. I know I've been hearing about it forever.
Yeah.
So it's had a tumultuous history to say the least. But again, any Dune's better than no Dune. So
yeah, I would rather have more thoughtful Dune, even if I'm not 100% behind it, than the just in shitification of Dune like Disney has done with Star Wars.
Fair enough.
And I might get some flack for that because I know like there are people that either really fucking hate Acolyte, really love Acolyte. I never actually watched it just because I'm so fucking burned out on all of Disney's bullshit.
I liked Acolyte a lot.
I did really like Andor, and I'm very, very much looking forward to season 2 of Andor. But like all the other Star Wars shit, I'm so burned out, and I don't want that to happen to Dune.
I completely agree. I will say, just as an aside, Skeleton Crew is pretty good, so you should give that a chance.
All right, maybe.
Maybe.
I'll have to rebuy Disney Plus.
I guess, I don't know, one of the last things I got to say is we didn't get a lot of Theodosia this episode.
Which was very weird for her to just be a Tlaylaxu face dancer and then just nothing.
Yeah, that felt, I mean, the whole episode felt like whiplash, as they're wont to do. But that even felt like more so, because I was excited to see something come of that.
I was thinking, like, okay, Theodosia is now going to be sent into the palace as Inez, which, okay.
Or Harrow Harkonnen is my.
Or, so you want to go crazy on theory time, ready? Fucking Theodosia and Inez are going to do a little switcheroo or whatever. And Theodosia is going to live in the palace as Inez while Inez is off in the sisterhood doing, you know, sisterhood things.
Mm, okay. That's interesting.
Now, I don't know how long Telelaxu face dancers can do their thing, but I can guarantee you it's not 10 years.
Sure.
Like,
yeah, no, I agree with that.
Maybe it'll be enough to get Inez off world or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Oh, that's true. That could be something. That's an interesting thing. We'll have to see next week, but it just feels like they have this really, really, really cool like character and ability and everything, and for them to introduce it, one, so late in the series, and two, not touch it for an entire episode when we only have two left. It felt odd to me. It felt a little off. So hopefully it plays a much bigger part in the finale.
Unless they're just throwing shit at the wall to introduce all these concepts here in the show, so that way they don't have to introduce the concepts in the movie.
Sure.
Which I think would be really shitty. I think the idea of using Theodosia to buy time to get Inez off world to the sisterhood is ultimately the reason why she's there.
Yeah.
It's just that Valya used Theodosia for a little bit of therapy in her own time as well.
Right.
I did really like the very quick, you know, Atreides sword salute.
Sure.
That was a fun little
sarcastic, you know, Atreides sword salute.
Yeah. No, I thought that was good.
There's a running joke on the wonderful Lower Decks Star Trek animated series where one of the characters will do sarcastic Vulcan salutes. And that's funny. Everyone, they get pissed off about it all the time. It's great.
Okay. So I'm going to go back to the scene where we were angry about Desmond's shield and his plot armor.
Okay.
Except I'm not going to be angry about Desmond's shield and his plot armor because we already did that. I want to know why the fuck these insurgents have barrels full of spice. Do you know how like a fucking briefcase of the shit would buy an entire planet? These motherfuckers just have barrels of spice and you're keeping your fucking dress in that shit too. Like,
so here's my weak explanation of that. Is that we have not been, or that universe at this time has not experienced the slowdown of distribution of spice like we have it in the movies.
Yeah.
So they're just now starting to feel that.
Vladimir Harkonnen hasn't put his fucking grip on the shit yet.
Right.
So I will.
It seems to be a much more common commodity in this universe than it ever is in the movies and the later, you know, 10,000 years into the future.
Yeah. Speaking of Vladimir Harkonnen, I love the parallels between Harrow and Vladimir. Like, yeah. Harrow is like, I think Harrow will become much more ruthless and brutal over time as he grows older and everything. And, you know, that is kind of obviously inspired by Vladimir and everything, but it's like through Harrow we're seeing a younger, less powerful gross Vladimir. Yeah, also less gross. Less balloony 1984 yeah. David Lynch fly around and then have a weird you know, sexual tension with your prisoner before you pull out the clock piece covering his heart and then black blood.
His heart plug. We all have
that. Yeah. Meanwhile, Sting is just looking on with the weirdest, like, most intense smile on his face.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, I'm going to go watch the 84 Lynch film now. Bye.
So this, you reminded me of one thing. The cloth that Desmond keeps.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. So, I did want to talk about that, too, because I have some thoughts, but I want to know yours.
Yeah, I got a couple here. So I think we on the show are being led to believe that it is part of a Bene Gesserit robe. I think that is the clear cut. Here's what we want you to think. But in the very first scene of this show, we get kind of a close up on the fabric as he's putting it into his pocket. Mm-hmm. And to me, there was a pretty distinct texture on the fabric. And it looked a whole heck of a lot like Harrow Harkonnen's sleeves. So,
like whale fur?
Could this be some whale fur or whale fur adjacent fabric, which still fits into the Tula is his mother theory, because she would have that growing up on Lankaville. So, I don't know. That it just I think it could go either way a little bit.
So my you're getting very close to what my theory was, which is basically it was the last like piece of cloth that was left with him as a like baby or mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah. Yep.
Basically, Desmond's still holding on to his Banky.
Sure. I like that. I'll buy that for a dollar. Yeah.
Yeah. Overall, Shai Hulud's, I don't know, man. Like six and a half.
That is maybe. Higher than I was going to go. I was going to go an even five on this. It is not what I would expect the penultimate episode to be.
Yeah, no. All right. I'll give it a 5.5 just because I think it was really carried a lot by Francesca and having a new character that we hadn't seen, but someone that is incredibly important, and Taboo does a fantastic job portraying Francesca.
In that, I'm going to interrupt you just for a second. In that same vein, Lila/Raquella carried a lot of this episode as well. So Chloe Leah's, is it Lee? Leah?
Yeah, I think.
She did a phenomenal job portraying Raquella in this.
And it was cool to see Raquella like in a spry, like not on your deathbed, but like full of energy kind of Raquella. Because we didn't get a coherent Raquella at all in this show. The only flashback to Raquella that we saw was old ass Raquella, like about to die, but still like young enough to convince Valia to stay around and, you know, teach her, you know, some of the Bene Gesserit or some of the sisterhood teachings and everything. But this is a very like excitable Raquella. So it's a side to her that we hadn't seen yet.
Yeah. So I think those two characters carry this episode, and the rest of it was just kind of lackluster.
I've given Jen a lot of praise in previous episodes, but I'm getting pretty tired of her bullshit. Like fucking, just get with it or get the fuck out of the way, dude. Like,
I'm going to disagree there. Just, I feel like she's finding her purpose within the sisterhood now. I think her defiance has, yes, been a little bit of tedious at times, but it is being put to good use here. So I think she found a good spot to put that.
Sure. But also like fucking figure it out. Hurry up.
Sure. Well, we got one more, man. We got one more of these.
One more.
Yep. And hopefully a lot of stuff gets answered next week. So
Probably won't, but who knows?
We'll see. We'll see. Any final thoughts before we wrap this one up?
I really hope they don't fuck it. I mean, I know they're going to because it's Brian lore, but I really don't fuck it up.
Well, second to that. Yeah. I agree. So there's still a lot that can go down. And, you know, heck, they might introduce a whole bunch of new stuff in this last episode. Who knows?
Fuck. There is one thing that I forgot to add. And before we leave, I got to talk about it.
Okay, go.
So, oh, buddy. So when Lila, not Lila, Raquella, is there for the first time, we get such an important line that is said between them. So like Jen's talking about, you know, the dreams and everything. And then Lila interrupts and is like, what was seen was the gaping maw of Shai Hulud swallowed by darkness. I have the whole thing here. Gaping maw of Shai Hulud swallowed by darkness until two eyes stared back. It wasn't a nightmare. It was prescience. I foresaw the reckoning that would drive the Imperium to tyranny. If he succeeds, humanity will backslide to self-destruction. He isn't Desmond. He isn't Desmond. Humanity backsliding to self-destruction. Motherfucker, you know who this is.
It's, oh yeah, I came away from this with strong. This has got to be Leto.
It has to, like, okay. Desmond being the harbinger to Leto. Sure, I can get behind that, but the only thing that like doesn't sit well with me is the robotic voice with the eyes and like the keying that those like bright blue, because like they make a very distinct different blue for the eyes of Ubad that Michaela has compared to the bright blue that the machines have and everything. Hmm. And the weird like robot voice doesn't necessarily line up with it being Leto, but also like Shai Hulud has a kind of like machiney sound as it like envelops things. And mm-hmm. I don't,
could be a red herring. Could be just a red herring. You never know. It
could be, but man, like the line, if he succeeds, humanity will backslide to self-destruction.
Well, but I'm excited. I'm excited to see if we find out, man. So what do you say we get back together next week and see if any or all or none of these predictions take place
for our last episode of Dune Prophecy?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. All right. Let's do that. As always, we are on the internet in many places. The place that I'm most active is on Blue Sky because I do all of our socials. Zach avoids social media, but that's fine. We are on Blue Sky at DuneMinute.com. You can get in touch with us on Instagram at TheDuneMinute, and you can email DuneMinute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch. As a reminder as well, we talked about it in the last episode of Season 1 of The Dune Minute, which if you haven't listened to it, all of Season 1 is out. There's 148 episodes. Go to town. We had one listener on Blue Sky tell me that they listened to the entire series over the course of like a week and a half, which I think is crazy. How do you not hate our voices at this point? But, you know, love that for you. Thank you. But at the end of our last episode of Season 1, we talked about some of our upcoming plans for summer school in January, February, March. Probably that will be it. I think we're not entirely certain on timelines yet, so TBD on that. But definitely January. Speaking of the Butlerian Jihad and everything, we're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about Holtzman. Stick around. There's more Dune Minute after next week's episode.
Yep, that's right. So super excited to get those started. So right after the holidays. So we're just, you know, a week or so away from Christmas at this point. So after the holidays, we're going to be hitting the recording chairs. We're hopefully doing it face to face.
Yeah, so a little production behind the scenes. All of these episodes we've been recording remotely from each other, just because timing wise and everything, to give Zach time to edit the episode and get it out as quickly as possible. This made sense to us. But yeah, get back on the couch, have the cats, you know, annoy the shit out of us with random noises and stuff that they make. But yeah, it'll be good to do that again. So
yeah, agreed. All right, man. Well, we will catch you next week. See ya.
See you later.